Welcome to another episode of UBC Arts on Air, a program profiling the dynamic faculty of arts, and I'm your host, Ira Nadell. This evening, I'm delighted to welcome Jonathan Gerard, Assistant Professor of Conducting and Ensembles and the Director of Orchestras. Jonathan, welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Ira. It's great to be here tonight.
Well, let's start with your role in the School of Music. What does this phrase mean, Director of Orchestras?
Well, what it means is that I'm in charge of training the students that are getting degrees in orchestral instruments and providing them the musical foundation they need to be successful in orchestral ensembles. And so we accomplish that through the many concerts that happen throughout the year. And I work on training them to be true orchestra musicians so we can send them out as professionals.
Well, what does this actually mean? Let's say I play the cello and I'm young, new to the program, but obviously I want to become a member of the orchestra. So what are you going to do with me?
So if let's say you just arrived fresh at UBC, the first thing that you would be greeted by is an audition packet. And you would then have to figure out what works are being required to play for this audition and listen to them and try to understand what the general conventions for those works are. You would then come in to an audition and you would play for me in a panel of people. And then we would determine your seating within the orchestra. And then you would show up at your first orchestra rehearsal and we'd be talking about what type of preparation is really required for the orchestra rehearsal, what sort of technical skills are required to play in an ensemble. And throughout your experience at UBC, there would be many, many different seating auditions where you'd receive feedback from myself and other faculty members. And you would basically be learning how to hone your skills as a player in the ensemble, and also to improve your skills as someone that will be taking many auditions in life. So there's that double-faceted component of orchestral training, in my opinion.
Doesn't this mean that you yourself have to have this comprehensive understanding of the various instruments, players, positioning, so forth in an orchestra? I mean, you are the one in charge of the whole.
It is true, and I think that you don't need to completely understand every instrument and be a master at playing it. As the New York Times critic Olin Downs once said, you don't need to lay the egg to eat the omelet. You do have to have a good sense of how to guide someone and have a sense of empathy for what they're doing as a musician in order to really help them in their journey and of improvement. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in a particular season, you have X number of concerts. Are you the one who, just to back up for a second, selects the music to be performed, and then you've made a decision, or I don't quite know how it's done, and then you share that, obviously, with your players and give them the parts?
That's right. So basically, I plan the entire season at least a year in advance. And I'm trying to balance many things in terms of the training that they're receiving. So I want to make sure that they will have played representational works of all kinds of different styles and genres. And so because in their 4 years of training, they can't play all the orchestral repertoire, but we can certainly play many styles that they will have to play in the real world. And so that's really my goal, to expose them to all of those types of things.
Well, let's think of an individual concert. What are you looking for, not so much from the player's point of view, but in terms of the program? Do you try to balance out different historical periods, pieces that might emphasize certain solos as opposed to not, or composers who've been underrepresented? What's some of the thinking that goes into selecting material for a program?
Everything that you just mentioned. And, it's a lot of, in terms of choosing specific programs, you're thinking of things on a micro level, and you're also thinking of them on a very macro level. So over the course of 4 years, how many Beethoven symphonies will they play? How many Brahms symphonies? What sort of new works will they perform? And are they getting enough of those things? And then on a very micro level, per concert, does this concert program make sense? Is it going to be effective? What's the workload going to be like for the players? For instance, we just did a concert with the Rite of Spring. So the other two works that I chose to balance that were two Ravel works. One was the Pavane, and the other was Mother Goose Suite. And both of those do not have the technical demands that Rite of Spring has. And they're a very, very different musical style that the students had to achieve. So although all those works are basically written within a small time window in history, they're extraordinarily different.
Okay, so on that particular evening, did you do the Stravinsky as the last piece? I'm interested in how did you do the order of this?
We did. So the order for that concert was the Pavane to open, and it has that absolutely exquisite horn solo. And then we did Mother Goose, Intermission, and Rite of Spring. I mean, it's really hard to put anything after the Rite of Spring. I think that starting with the Pavane worked extraordinarily well because it just kind of welcomes everyone in a very calm and friendly way.
Well, I think this is important to acknowledge this process because a concert goer will come in, get the program, see the four or five pieces that are there, and not think too much about why these pieces, why this order, why tonight. They've often gone because it says Brahms, and they want to hear a piece by Brahms.
I agree. I mean, I think that unlike a professional orchestra, here at the School of Music, we have the educational component for the musicians within the orchestra. So we have the freedom to choose a program that will tailor to their needs in terms of what they really need to grow as players. That is tricky because it's best when all the goals can be mutual and can be focused, but sometimes that's not always possible. But I think we really achieved it in this last concert.
Excellent. Okay, so let's turn to conducting. Now, I've been fascinated for many years with conductors and their story. So I want to begin by asking you, how did you get started as a conductor? Was it something you woke up one morning and announced to everyone that you're going to be a conductor? Or was it progressive? That is to say, you played several instruments and decided, I think I want to conduct.
Well, there were many things that kind of, like you said, made me want to become a conductor. And I think the first of which was watching Leonard Bernstein as a child on TV in the young person's concerts that he used to offer and just being completely enamored with what he was able to do, how he was able to explain music, how he was able to get these group of musicians to just sound incredible. And his excitement for music was also contagious for me. So that was one component of it. The other component of it was when I was a young child and I actually heard the Boston Symphony for the first time. And I remember they were doing Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun. And to hear the acoustics of that hall and just the sonority of the orchestra was something that I couldn't even... I just knew that I had to keep experiencing this. And so I became more and more interested in orchestral music. I started looking at scores when I was in the sixth grade. I conducted the middle school band for a piece, and I can only imagine how terrible it was. But nonetheless, I was very determined to learn this craft. So I think those are the things that really pushed me towards this career. It was really the sound of the orchestra and just watching Bernstein and seeing how well he could communicate with people.
Well, but then do you pursue this career by selecting an instrument of study, whether it's the piano, violin? You do your work on the instrument, but always with the goal of conducting in mind? I mean, How is one educated to be a conductor?
It's a very good question. And in North America, generally speaking, you cannot get an undergraduate degree in conducting. So you have to become a musician, generally an instrumentalist first and foremost, and then explore some sort of master's degree in conducting. The only place I think that offers an undergraduate diploma is Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. But there really is a lot to be said for learning the craft of playing an instrument before one becomes a conductor.
It's sort of like an actor, I would imagine, who at a certain point in one's career decides she or he wants to direct. And it only comes from their experiences before the camera, in front of the camera, that prepares them to step behind it, I suppose.
I think that's a really good analogy. I think that, you know, as a conductor, you're basically making music without an instrument. So to really learn how to do that, it's good to start off on an instrument and to really understand how you can communicate musically what you want.
What was your or is your instrument?
Well, I started off very young as a pianist, and then I learned viola, and then I learned saxophone. And so I actually have my undergraduate degree in saxophone. It's a classical saxophonist, which is a very unusual path to becoming a conductor.
That's fascinating. So tell us about your first experience conducting, not in the middle school, but sort of you're obviously following this path. You've graduated, presumably, from music school or whatever, and now you're about to embark on your conducting career. What was the first experience like?
Well, I think it's hard to say what the first experience is like, but I think that I remember standing up in front of orchestras as I got better and I was in front of better orchestras and just thinking what a fantastic experience this is. And I remember being terrified because you learn the craft of conducting in front of 90 people basically every time. Whereas if you're studying the violin, you're in a practice room or you're at home and you're figuring out whatever technical aspects you need to work on. But learning how to conduct, the only way to do it is in front of an orchestra. I mean, we can talk about the theory of conducting and the grammar of conducting and all that. But I remember being absolutely terrified the first time. And of course, as you get more and more familiar with that environment, you become less and less terrified, and you learn to let yourself be completely open to what's happening around you, which I think is one of the most important qualities a conductor needs to have.
What's the role of the orchestra in this? That is to say, do you get some feedback from the orchestra or a section of the orchestra or the first violinist who might, in a polite or sometimes impolite way, say, no, I think you're rushing this phrasing, or, you know, the dynamic is wrong for this section of the score?
It's hard to say because every orchestra member has a different opinion about what the conductor should be doing. And many of them think that they can be doing it too. And it's a tricky thing because they are not always the best ones to judge what's happening because they're in the heat of battle. So I find that what was very helpful to me is having really great teachers that have worked with me with an orchestra in some sort of masterclass or workshop environment. And they can kind of play more of a referee position, if you will, to understand what's actually happening and to help improve you as a conductor.
So if you can share with us, what was your worst experience as a conductor? Don't go pale now.
Well, I think the worst experience you can have as a conductor is having the orchestra do something that you don't expect them to do. And, you know, I've had many nightmares where I've stood on the podium and given a upbeat to get the orchestra started and nothing happens. So that's kind of what's always in the back of your mind. What if I just can't get them to do what we all need to do together. But I think, you know, the worst experience for me was not being able to manipulate the orchestra or to guide them towards the tempo that I wanted to. And I remember having this experience conducting a Strauss waltz. And it's really tricky dealing with Strauss's music because there is so much finesse to it that's required and so much subtlety. And because most waltzes are really in one, your conducting gesture is bigger to acknowledge that, and you're not beating every three beats. And so the real issue becomes, how do you accelerate? How do you decelerate? And how do you really understand how to move that orchestra the way it needs to go and get their attention and do it in a way that sounds organic? And that was a real struggle for me at first, starting out. I remember very clearly feeling like I was waving my arms and I was not in control. And I think that's one of the toughest things as a conductor, being able to feel like you're not able to influence musically what's happening.
Do you feel more comfortable with younger players as opposed to more mature players? Can you detect a difference between a youth orchestra and, I don't know, a senior professional orchestra?
Absolutely. They both have wonderful qualities about them. With youth orchestras, they tend to want to go faster. And they're always very excited. And so as a conductor, you're always monitoring what the orchestra is doing and maybe having to kind of tap on the brakes here and there. And with a professional orchestra, they're always slightly behind you. So you're feeling like you're pulling them forward. So those are, I think, fundamentally the major differences. And to understand what that each ensemble needs to get to the right tempo or whatever it is you're trying to achieve, it could be a very different thing for each ensemble. But I absolutely love working with students because it's very gratifying for me to see them succeed and for them to learn to love orchestra as much as I do.
That's excellent. Now, tell me a bit about the kind of music you most enjoy conducting. And I believe you have a real interest in contemporary music.
I have an interest in contemporary music, and I've been doing quite a bit of it lately. But, you know, I really like actually conducting Ravel's works. And it's interesting because when I was a young kid, I always fancied that I would be the best Mahler conductor ever, and, you know, how could I conduct anything but Mahler? And then you start to look at other repertoire and other composers, and you start to learn these styles and say, geez, my Mozart isn't bad, you know? And I do a pretty good Ravel. So it's interesting because what you think you want to conduct might not be what you do really, really well. So for me, I've now really come to love Ravel's works, and the subtlety within them.
When I refer to contemporary music a moment ago, how do you define that term? Who do you see as contemporary composers at the moment?
Well, I think that it's an interesting question. I mean, depends what your perspective is, right? Because up until maybe 20 or 30 years ago, many people would consider a work like Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale to be a contemporary piece, even though it was written in the 1920s. Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was written over 100 years ago, and it sounds more modern than some things that have been written 2 years ago. So I think it's tricky to really to define what contemporary music is if you're just perceiving it from an oral perspective. But there are so many wonderful composers that are that are working today. I've been working very closely with Steve Chapman here at the School of Music, and we recorded a CD last year, which was just released on Center Discs, of his Magnificat. And Steve's music is really not like Stravinsky. It's very tonal, and yet that's contemporary music. And I've conducted things like Lachenmann, which is not very tonal, but some of his music was not very tonal, and it's 40 and 50 years old. So I think that, you know, the great thing about contemporary music is that it encompasses so many different qualities now.
What about opera? Have you conducted, or do you wish to conduct, an opera?
I would love to conduct an opera. I've done some opera before. I've conducted opera in Iowa, and I also work as the assistant conductor at the Ohio Light Opera, so I spend my summers there conducting opera.
Different kinds of challenges, right? Even more comprehensive in terms of your understanding of the work, because it's not only the music, it's the acting, the singing, etc.
Exactly. With opera, it's really a complex endeavor because you're now dealing with performers on two different physical levels. You're dealing with the musicians in the pit, you're dealing with the stage, which is above them. And the coordination of those two groups is also tricky as well. And singers are moving all over the stage depending on what the director has done for blocking. So you might be dealing with a singer that's turned the wrong way just at the point you need to communicate with them. And so it has its challenges in a way that if you're just doing a concert work, you can see the singer generally right next to you and you proceed. But it's a wonderful art, and it's really fascinating for me to work with singers and to bring, there's something about conducting opera, there's just a dramatic element to it that doesn't imminently exist in symphonic works.
All right, so let's consider for a second your ideal program. We're sitting here planning a concert that you're going to conduct a year or 18 months from now. What would you select?
Well, maybe what we could do is talk about what we're doing for our tour in April. So we are, the UBC Orchestra is taking a tour in April 5th through 10th, going through British Columbia and Alberta. And we're going to be performing works on that tour, which will be Strauss Don Juan, Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with David Gillam, and then Beethoven Symphony No. 5. And the reason I selected this repertoire is because I feel it's actually a hybrid of the last two concerts we're doing in the end of this coming, the end of the season here in March and April. And I feel that the Strauss Don Juan is going to, it's such a showpiece for orchestra. It's really a virtuoso piece for orchestra. And it also addresses the needs of the students in terms of preparing them for orchestral auditions. Almost every single instrument has a major excerpt from this work. So it's really an ideal piece for the orchestra to be playing. So there's that. The Tchaikovsky Concerto will be perfect because it's not terribly difficult for the orchestra, and we're able to feature an extraordinary faculty soloist, David Gillam. And Beethoven 5, there is something about that work that has an incredible power communicating to audiences. And it's interesting because so many people know the first motive of Beethoven 5, but they don't know the work. They haven't ever truly been exposed to the entire symphony. So every time I've done this piece, I feel like it's a special treat to bring this work to life with an orchestra, and especially with the students, who also, or many of them, don't know the entire work. So that, I think, is really an ideal concert. It shows, we have a showpiece that shows the virtuosity of the orchestra. We're showing a fantastic soloist and how well we'll accompany him. And we're taking a major, major orchestral work on tour and exposing that repertoire and the students to many wonderful concert opportunities within the two provinces.
So how early in the process should we start rehearsing?
Well, we're going to read the tour repertoire in January for one rehearsal, and then the orchestra is performing. They have to start their rehearsal cycle for the opera immediately after that. So the idea is I want to expose them to what they have to do early on so that they can assess what challenges lie ahead of them. Then when we start rehearsing the March concert in the middle of February, they will already have been exposed to two works on that program. We're also doing Mozart Linz Symphony on that. And then we have, for the final concert, we're doing Gershwin American in Paris, and then the student concerto winner will also perform on that, and then Beethoven 5. So you can see that I'm taking kind of the best things that are tourable from those two concerts on the tour, and we're spreading out over two concert cycles the repertoire that's going on tour. So rather than just taking the final concert, we really can spend a lot of time preparing what we're going to be showcasing.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. So just to wind things up, I wonder if you could explain to me a bit of a mystery, and that is the connection between flying and conducting.
Well, there's quite a connection between flying and conducting. Controlling an orchestra is very much like flying a plane. And orchestras respond best to small corrections. If you want to move a tempo or change a dynamic, just like in a small plane, if the plane is trimmed out properly, you can really fly it with your thumb and index finger on the yoke. And the same is true of an orchestra that's really been well prepared and that is responsive. So I think that's one of the things that, you know, understanding just how much effort needs to go into changing something in the orchestra, it's often much less than we would perceive it to be. So I think that's the biggest similarity with flying, that you don't need to do much. You don't want to overcorrect for something that happens, you know?
Yes, I should have prefaced that by saying you are a pilot.
I am a pilot, yes. And, you know, inherently, the airplane wants to fly, just like the orchestra wants to play. So as long as it's going along okay, you don't need to do all that much to get the next step to happen or the next turn or whatever the correlation is.
Did the love of flying develop simultaneously with the interest in conducting?